Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
As we move into the new year, we are going to try something new here at Research on Religion. Based on some comments we have received, I will be shortening our introductory segment and introducing the week's guest right off the bat. This is akin to what Econ Talk, the podcast that inspired our show, does, and given that imitation is the highest form of flattery, we give a big shout-out to Russ Roberts for all his innovative work. We will give this new format a try for a few weeks and see how it goes. And that brings me to today's guest, Dr. Jeff Levin, the University Professor of Epidemiology and Population Health at Baylor University, and a distinguished senior scholar at Baylor's Institute for Studies of Religion, the sponsor of this podcast. He has appeared on our show once before and is the author of numerous books, including his most recent edited volume, Judaism and Health, A Handbook of Practical, Professional, and Scholarly Resources. We'll link to that book and his other ones on our website, so please be sure to check it out. Jeff, welcome back to Research on Religion. It's been a long time.
Hey, Tony. It's good to be here. I look forward to this.
I have to tell our audience that we are recording this on December 12, 2013, and it's likely to air in the new year, 2014, and I should note that the Baylor Bear football team has just been selected to the Fiesta Bowl. I think that's out in Arizona. It's a big deal because it's the bowl championship series, and they've had a wonderful, wonderful year. And I was just wondering, given your work in epidemiology, if you've been tracking green and gold fever down there in Waco.
Well, I think it counts as an actual disease entity. No, it's been amazing, and I think if the people who follow Baylor realize this hasn't just been football. Over the last couple of years, we've really been the top athletic program in the country. The people have quantified the number of wins in women's basketball and men's basketball and baseball and softball and football, and we've been the top program, which is, believe me, blows as many minds down here as it does anywhere else. So who knew when I came to Baylor a few years ago that this was an athletic mecca? So we're all just in a state of shock.
It must be because you came down to Waco.
No, I don't think it has anything to do with it.
Okay, well, yeah, it does indicate how Baylor is really moving up in the academic world. I know sports is sports and academics is another thing, but often two times the two go together.
They absolutely go hand in hand, yeah. And I'm sure that the preeminence of RG3 a couple of years ago not only led to the new football stadium we're building, but to the huge amount of success that our development office has had in raising money for other things, including the new business school. So you're right. It all goes hand in hand.
Well, sick'em bears.
Right, sick'em bears.
So Judaism and health, huh? Last time we spoke to you, which was a couple years ago, you were focusing on the role of health and religion more generally. So has there been a new shift in your attention specifically to Judaism? And actually, before you answer that, tell us how you moved from studying epidemiology, which would seem to be a pretty lucrative career in and of itself, to really focusing on the impact of religion and health.
Okay, well, actually, I'm an epidemiologist, and people here kind of forget that. I am at an Institute for Studies of Religion, and I'm not a social scientist or a sociologist or a theologian or a rabbi. I'm a biomedical scientist, and I've been doing this for about 30 years. And actually, as an epidemiologist, I trained in specifically behavioral and psychosocial factors and health and illness. That's been my focus, and have been studying religion all along. Within my field, there actually has been a small cadre of people who have looked at religious factors in health. Not a big area, but just like probably in political science and economics and psychology and other fields, a core group of folks that have studied religion. So I've been doing this since the early to mid 80s. What's changed for me the last few years is a focus specifically on Judaism, because in the larger religion and health field, there's probably been north of 4,000 published empirical studies on the topic, which is kind of amazing, but these go back decades. But minimal work has been done on Jews. And this is near and dear to my heart. I'm Jewish, and I've my bread and butter has been studying this phenomenon and wondering all along, does this information translate to my people? And really what sparked this to me, the story goes back. It's a funny story, Tony. 1997.
Oh, my gosh, that's a
Cincinnati,
century ago.
In the fall for the GSA meeting. This is a professional society for folks who study aging, a gerontological society. It's a meeting that I used to go to every year. And I was a panel discussant on something related to aging and religion. Well, I had a free day, and I was in Cincinnati. And it just so happens, serendipitously, Cincinnati is the home to HUC, or HUC, Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. This is the main rabbinical seminary and graduate school for Reform Judaism, one of the denominations of Judaism. And I thought, gosh, I was raised in the Reform movement. My wife and I are conservative Jews now, but I'd never been to HUC, and here I was in town, and all the great rabbis I'd known in my life had gone there. I thought, well, here's an opportunity to go there, make a Hajj, or a pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took a bus to the campus. It's right across from the University of Cincinnati, and I spent the afternoon there and went to the library and went to the museum and the bookstore and just had a fantastic time. Now, why am I telling this story?
Well, wait, I got to pause you a minute there. The Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, I guess that's a little bit surprising to me that's in Cincinnati.
That's the historic home of liberal Judaism in the United States. It dates to the 19th century, and the seminary is there. So that the whole seminary and the degree-granting institution is there. So for Reform Jews, this is their, Vatican City.
it seems like it's a pretty big place. You mentioned that they had a museum and a bookstore.
I mean, it's a whole campus.
Wow.
It's a whole campus. It's not like a building. It's a whole campus and school.
Wow.
So here I am. I take the bus there from the gerontology meeting, and I'm wide-eyed. I'm very excited to be there. Again, this is 1997, and I'm wandering the halls, and I saw on the wall a piece of paper advertising for a noon seminar, a brown bag seminar. It's just like it at the University of Washington or anywhere else. If you're at a university, if your listeners know, there's always, every day of the week, there are guest lecturers and seminars. So here was this thing on the wall. And I wish there were no cell phones with cameras in those days. I would have taken a picture of this. I don't remember what it said exactly, but it was something. But there was a talk being advertised, and it was something like, the Reform congregation is a locus for holistic healing programming or services or something. I mean, that was almost what it said. And Tony, I thought this was the goofiest thing I ever saw in my life, advertising, a talk on this subject. And I thought, healing services, healing program in a Reform temple. That's, maybe in a, Christian Science or Wednesday night prayer in a, a Pentecostal church or a charismatic church, or but in a reform temple, the most liberal, rational, naturalistic branch of Judaism. It seemed as likely to me as finding out there was going to be a charismatic healing service in a congregationalist church or something like that. So I thought, wow, I've got to go to this talk. Well, I looked at it, and it said the talk was from noon to 1, and I looked at my watch, and it was literally, it was like 2 minutes after 1. So it was like, Homer Simpson noise.
Boom, no.
missed it. Yeah. So, so I came home from that trip, and it had planted a seed in my mind that, like, gosh, is there a tradition of writing rabbinical commentary, what have you, on healing, on health and healing in Judaism? And is there a movement? Is there programming? Are there liturgies? Have people written on this topic? I had no idea. While I am a religious scholar, I don't purport to be a Jewish religious scholar. I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a theologian. I'm a medical scientist who's an active lay person in my congregation. So I don't have any special expertise. And just the idea, the juxtaposition of healing with Judaism, especially the modern Western Judaism, just kind of blew my mind.
Now, were you doing, I have to stop you a minute here. Were you doing, writing papers on religion and health at this period of time?
Absolutely. I've been doing this since the mid-90s, but I've been doing research, like analyzing survey data and doing regression analyses and publishing in, you know, empirical papers in journals showing that high levels of this religious behavior or that significantly predicted less depressive symptoms in this sample or that. And it's just basic, you know, social science, epidemiologic research. I wasn't writing florid essays about spirituality or healing or anything.
So
research I was doing didn't have anything to do with Jews.
I see how this is then. So you were doing your typical multivariate regressions.
You got it.
But this was something that a group of individuals were embracing and, you know, taking to the health marketplace, I guess, to heal people.
Essentially, and the idea that maybe there was programming, you know, there's stuff going on in congregations. This whole thing was so wild to me. So I come home. So here it is. Again, it's 16 years ago, and I need to tell the audience, as a religious Jew, every week, part of my regimen, the phrase we use is learn Torah, which is a Jewish way of saying a Bible study.
Right.
And the Jewish calendar, we read through the entire Torah, the five books of Moses, every year. We start basically with the Jewish New Year, right after the Jewish New Year, a holiday called Simchas Torah in the fall. And we start with Genesis 1. And this a week before that, the following year, we finish up with Deuteronomy and we start over. And all of Jewish Bible study is essentially key to this cycle. So I've been doing this for decades, and every year I have different commentaries that I study from different rabbis, and some of them are ancient and some are modern. And so this is just part of my study I've been doing for all my adult life. And so when I came home from Cincinnati, I thought, you know, I'm going to start taking notes. So every time I would see something in the Bible or maybe a reference to the Talmud or to the Midrash or something, I'd scribble down on a post-it note. Anything that had to do with healing or disease or life expectancy. And I started scribbling this down and saving them on these post-it notes. And Tony, this went on for like 10 years.
Wow.
And so finally, about a few years ago, a little bit before we came here to Baylor in 2009, I was cleaning out my files. We lived in Kansas. I was cleaning out my files, and I found this collection of post-it notes, and I dumped it out on my desk at home. And there were hundreds of multicolored post-it notes, each one with like a different reference to the Bible or the Talmud or to this rabbi or that rabbi. And I thought, you know, as an academic, I thought, you know, gee, maybe there's a paper here. So I kind of collated all these post-it notes, and I ended up writing an article on what the Jewish scriptures and canon had to say about health and illness and so on, citing hundreds of references to scripture. And there was stuff on healing, and there was stuff on disease prevention, and stuff on mental health, and you name it, all kinds of stuff. And ended up publishing a paper in one of the peer-reviewed medical journals. And, you know, it's terrific. And that soon discovered that I wasn't the first person to do this. Somebody else had beat me to it and had done a much more thorough job many decades earlier. This was in a book by a doctor named Julius Preuss. And this is a great book by the name of Biblical and Talmudic Medicine, for anyone who's interested. It was published in, I think, 1911, so over 100 years ago. And Dr. Preuss, of course, this is before Index Medicus or PubMed or computers or anything, he scoured the entirety of the Jewish scriptures and the rabbinical writings. It took him decades. And he came up with this book, and it's almost 1,000 pages. It's essentially a medical textbook. And it's divided into chapters on anatomy and physiology and ophthalmology and infectious diseases and so on. Essentially, it's a medical textbook with thousands and thousands of references to the Bible and to the religious codes and to the Talmud and the Mishnah and the Midrash and even some references to the New Testament. It essentially suggested that the Jewish scriptures were a font of medical information. almost akin to like a whole folk medical system. And it's just remarkable stuff to me. I found all this information.
How easy was it to find that book? I mean, you mentioned it was written in 1911.
How easy to find it? Well, that's another funny story. I was, throughout my adult life, although I've given it up the last few years, I was a member of the Jewish Book Club, which is like the, you know, conservative book club or other book clubs, and definitely an addictive behavior for me. And more than several years ago, the book was translated into English by Dr. Fred Rosner, who's a very well-known Orthodox Jewish doctor and rabbi in New York. He translated it, and so there was an English translation available, published by Jason Aronson, which is, reprints a lot of classic books, so in New Jersey. So in that month's brochure from the Jewish Book Club, here was this reprint from almost 100 years earlier. So I bought the book, and, you know, it's not exactly bedside reading. It's essentially a medical textbook.
Yeah.
It's incredible, and it made me realize, wow, I hear I did this little paper a few years ago, and this guy, you know, this guy did a thorough job. But what's fascinating is that when you talk about Judaism and medicine, there's so much more to this field, as I've discovered, than just a rabbi from 100 years ago or a contemporary scientist accumulating references to scriptures. There's all kinds of other interconnections. And over the last 25 years especially, a variety of professional fields have evolved at the broad intersection of medicine and health and Judaism.
I want to go through a number of those different fields. In your book that you just published here, Judaism and Health, which we'll link to on our website, goes through these. You have separate chapters, and you have guest authors in there writing on these different fields. And so that indicates to me that there's a lot of people out there writing about this.
Yes.
But in the late 1990s, or perhaps the earlier in the century when you discovered this biblical and Talmudic medicine book by Julius Preuss, did you mention this to anybody and say, hey, I think I'm going to write about Jewish healing? And I mean, in the field of epidemiology, when you're all dealing with, you know, computer programming and test tubes and beakers and all that kind of stuff, anybody look at you and go, oh, really?
Well, I got the "oh, really" thing in graduate school, just to even want to focus on religion,
oh, okay.
Sexuality. So to turn my focus to Judaism, I mean, at this point, most people that knew me figured I was a lost cause. So, but actually, to kind of get at your first question. So again, you know, here's all this writing in the Jewish scriptures dating back to the time of the Torah, to the Bible. Question is, what have people done with this information? Well, it turns out the primary thing that people have done with this information is that over the centuries, information in the Bible regarding health and healing has been informative for the responsa literature. Now, what's responsa literature? Responsa are, the word in Hebrew is tshuvot. And in the Chuvot literature, this is a literature compiled very informally over centuries in which people make inquiries to rabbis, and rabbis who are rabbinic authorities or decisors for particular communities or movements, and they're known as poskim, they make decisions regarding ethical issues as they relate to halacha, relate to Jewish law. And a large, significant proportion of all the responsa literature relates to issues regarding health and healing and medicine and medical ethics. So there's this long tradition dating back centuries of inquiries of esteemed rabbinic authorities asking questions. And so much of this responsa literature, which continues to this day, there are volumes of rabbinic responsa on health and other topics in the Reform Judaism and Conservative Judaism and Orthodox Judaism and Reconstructionist Judaism, all the various denominations. And much of this, or I say almost all of this literature, is focused on very discreet issues like should I do this or that, abortion, euthanasia, transplant, so on, and rabbis have made their rulings. And this this hundreds of years of tradition of shuvot or responses led to the creation of a field of Jewish medical ethics. And this was this dates probably 1959 was the year I was born, incidentally. And in that year, a book came out called Jewish Medical Ethics by Lord Rabbi Manuel Yakubovitz, the late Rabbi Yakubovitz. This is a former chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, and he was a medical ethicist. And this was probably the birth of the field of medical ethics, and it was certainly the first work of Jewish medical ethics. And this was there was an effort to establish an academic, a scholarly field of study around ethical decision making in medicine, and he drew on this body of literature, responsive literature by great rabbis who themselves were drawing on all of these biblical and rabbinic references, for example, that were in the Julius Preuss book.
Can you give us a little bit of flavor for what some of these responses were, right? The shuvot, like maybe perhaps even go way back to Maimonides or look at something in the 1700s. Are there different questions that arise? Are there different responses?
I mean, it's funny. I was on a program as I'm speaking about a week ago at Rutgers. I was on a panel with Dr. David Ellenson, who's the retiring chancellor of Hebrew Union College, incidentally. And I told this story. He'd never heard this story. So I actually was on a panel with him. And I think at one point I made some reference to the responsive literature. I said, there's what? There's like hundreds of thousands of these. And he nodded. There's a tremendous literature. Basically, what has happened in the modern field of Jewish medical ethics or Jewish bioethics, the focus overwhelmingly of this literature has been on discrete clinical medical issues. So again, abortion, euthanasia, transplants, autopsies, so on. People have a question: Can I have an autopsy? And the traditional rabbinic ruling is that autopsies are forbidden. Now, among the more liberal branches of Judaism, if there's some benefit that can accrue to this, to benefit other people, we can learn about disease and so on, then it's permissible. And the point being, different rabbinic authorities from different traditions don't necessarily agree with each other. There are traditions, some traditions are more stringent, some are more lenient, but this is kind of a uniquely characteristic feature of Jewish medical ethics. Now, I don't know enough about Christian medical ethics or Hindu medical ethics, but there is not a uniform, nobody that speaks with a single voice. There's no Vatican issuing pronouncements. So basically there are different streams of Jewish bioethics. And on my bookshelf at home, for example, I probably have two entire bookshelves, nothing but books on Jewish medical ethics. And I myself am not an ethics scholar. I don't research it or teach it, but I have dozens and dozens, maybe 40 books or more, by Orthodox rabbis, by Reform, conservative rabbis, by secular Jewish scholars like Lori Zoloth. Wonderful, wonderful works. And while there certainly is a lot of overlap, one would expect there to be overlap if you're drawing on the same sources. At the same time, the opinions sometimes are a little different. So, you know, abortion is certainly an issue among certain more traditional segments of Judaism. The opinions on abortion might be similar to, the Roman Catholic Church, with some exceptions. Among more liberal Jewish rabbis, the opinions might resemble pronouncements from the Democratic National Committee, and everything in between. Mm-hmm. So certainly one interconnection among religion and medicine in Jewish life is the whole world of bioethics. But that's not the only thing. I mean, there are other points of connection as well.
I want to stick with the bioethics thing, because you do go through, as I mentioned, your book, Judaism and Health. There's different chapters on Jewish healing and caregiving and pastoral care and that. And bioethics is an important part of that book, and you have a number of different people writing on it. Now, as I mentioned, or as you mentioned, that this goes back centuries, you know, millennia. And there's always different questions. It seems, though, today we're on the cusp of some very major medical breakthroughs, things that were not even comprehensible in you know, just decades ago, things like cloning or DNA testing to find out when you might die. I mean, they're offering kits that you can buy over the internet to find that out. And it, also, we're talking about genetically modifying our children in the womb and possibly re-engineering life and the prolongation of life. This has all come about, oh, I don't know, in the past 20, 30 years. And I can only imagine that has reinvigorated this field of Jewish bioethics. How are Jews dealing with this? How are rabbinical scholars, folks like yourself in the health field, managing this change?
Well, I mean, there is a response to literature on some of these topics, and because of the diversity in approach, depending on where one is on the Jewish denominational spectrum, we don't use the word denomination, we use the word movement, but across the Jewish movements or denominations, the approach is different. There are very absolutist approaches that are kind of, I don't know, to use its Christian phrase, sola scriptura. There are other, for example, I go to a conservative synagogue, and then the Jewish denominational spectrum, conservative Judaism would be kind of somewhere center-right, maybe equivalent to the evangelicals in the Christian spectrum, and Reform Jews would be mainline Protestants, and Orthodox Jews would be Catholics. So maybe that's not exact. And just as there is a wide variety of evangelicals, there are a wide variety of conservative Jews. But one thing that connects all conservative Jews is our approach to Jewish law. And whereas in the Orthodox world, again, I'm generalizing, it's kind of letter of the law, and maybe in the Reform Jewish world, they aren't really concerned with Jewish law. As conservative Jews, we're very much about not so much stringently abiding by halacha or Jewish law, but by abiding by what is known as the halachic process. So there are things that arise in our modern world that weren't foreseen thousands of years ago or hundreds of years ago when these codes of law were being set down. But what's important is kind of the reasoning process. And so conservative rabbis want to abide by halacha, but at the same time come to decisions about things that weren't foreseen at the time. So for this is not a health-related example, but as a conservative Jew, you know, I drive my car to get the synagogue to go to services. To a more traditional Jew wouldn't use a car because we aren't supposed to do work and use electricity and so on during the Sabbath. If I were to do that, I wouldn't be able to get the services to worship. So in the conservative movement, we're a little more lenient. Where this comes into play in as far as ethical decision-making, I think there's more of a sense that we look at each situation on its merits and come to decisions that, on the whole, benefit the most people, and especially if there's a kind of an instrumental benefit for society, maybe there's an effort to be a little lenient. So, for example, I was just reading a response the other day, and I wish I could tell you where it came from, but it was actually a very traditional rabbi, and the question arose about transplantation with was it pig hearts or something? I don't even remember what it was. It was something I'd never even heard of. And my initial thought was, oh my gosh, you're going to say no. I mean, it's pork, you know, pigs. And it was actually mildly favorable because, after all, if this could be, the person wasn't going to eat the thing. This is going to use one of its organs. And if this could be used to sustain a human life, which is an ultimate value for us, you know, choose life, that kind of overrules all the difficulties there would be with having physical contact with a pig. And this might have been an Orthodox rabbi, as a matter of fact.
Wow. Hmm.
So, I mean, I guess my answer, my kind of cop-out answer, it's very nuanced. It's all very nuanced, but the important thing is that ultimately people are making reference to what appears in the scriptures and in the medieval rabbinic commentaries and in the Talmud, and people may come to different decisions, and their decision-making process or the hermeneutic may be different, but ultimately there's a sense that we have to reference what the revealed word has to say or what the rabbinic sages had to say, and that is ultimately informing these decisions. So certainly things will come up in the future that we never could have imagined, And maybe an ultra-Orthodox rabbi would say, we can't do this. This is forbidden because it wasn't in the Torah, and the rabbis didn't foresee it. But other rabbis will say, well, let's reason through this. Head transplants. I don't know.
Yeah.
Who knows what's coming in the future?
Yeah, exactly. Are there any issues right now, say, in the last, I don't know, 5 or 10 years that have really been buzzing around the Talmudic community and euthanasia or DNA testing?
I mean, the Talmudic community, that's a kind of ultra-Orthodox world. I'm not part of that. The Haredi world is the word. But I can tell you that within medical ethics, a real lacuna, a real gap that's very important has been the whole health policy arena. And, you know, we've just come out of this. I was at a meeting a week ago, and someone made some reference to, you know, we've just had this healthcare reform debate. And I always like to say we didn't have a healthcare reform debate. We had a medical expenditure reimbursement reform debate. We had no such healthcare reform debate. But the point is, there was legislation that was proposed, H.R. 3590, and there was the Patient Protection Act, Public Law 111, 148, 152. We've all heard of Obamacare. It's all been in the news and so on. The question is, what do Jewish ethical sources have to say about these issues, about these more communal or public health-related issues? And the interesting thing is, very little.
Mm.
Most of the commentary on the medical issues has been focused very much on these discrete clinical things. Should I get a transplant? Should I have an autopsy? Should I do this, that, or the other thing? But these larger issues of entitlement and collective responsibility, public health issues, there's really almost nothing. And this is disconcerting, and I think for a lot of people that are in the Jewish medical ethics field, and again, I want to make clear, I'm not explicitly a Jewish medical ethics scholar, but for people in that field, I think there's a tremendous need to begin to research these larger topics related to health policy and public health. But that has not stopped people from weighing in. And another place of interconnection in the Jewish Judaism and medicine spectrum has been in the health policy arena. And in the lead up to the legislation in, when it was 2010, a variety of Jewish groups, Jewish religious groups and policy-related groups and communal organizations, all weighed in on this legislation, just like the Catholic bishops did, just like the United Methodist Church did, just like other denominations did. And there were white papers and policy statements and lobbying going on in Washington by the Reform Jews and the Conservative Jews and the Orthodox Jews and by Jewish women's groups and Jewish men's groups and Jewish community organizations. And one can go to the internet and Google health policy and Jewish groups, and you can find all these statements that were made mostly in support of the legislation. And I think for the most part, most of the liberal Jewish groups probably were happy with the legislation that resulted, and maybe the more Orthodox groups weren't. And so that probably mirrors what went on in the Christian world as well. But people were certainly involved in lobbying and helping to craft legislation. And were all of these efforts consistent with things that were found in Scripture? Probably not. I mean, one of the criticisms has been that for a lot of religious groups, and this is true among Protestants and Catholics and Jews, that one's political calculus trumps one's religious values. And I can't really speak to that. I hope that's not the case, but I suspect it probably was in some cases. And result is now we have some legislation that's been passed and that's been partly been implemented, and people are very upset about it. But religious groups across the religious spectrum, not just within Judaism, played a vital role in crafting this legislation and in lobbying for it.
Now,
the very small Jewish community in this country were certainly at the table, again, along with the Roman Catholics and Methodists and other groups.
Has there been any reaction to it, much like the Catholic Church? The Catholic Church was in favor of major health care reform as it was being crafted, but then a year after it was passed, a set of regulatory mandates came down how to implement this thing. And they said, whoa, we didn't see this one coming. Let's sit and rethink this. Has the Jewish community been involved in that at all? Because I haven't heard very much.
I haven't heard much either. And it's possible that in some sectors of the more traditional Orthodox world, there have been people that have been very upset about this. But probably because most of the non-Orthodox world in Judaism is, I mean, if you look at, you know, you're a social scientist, you see research that tend to vote Democrat and tend to be more liberal than conservative. My guess is there are fewer people that are opposed to this legislation on the average, and as a result have not been as prominent alongside evangelical voices and Roman Catholic voices and so on. And also probably because issues related to reimbursements and mandates involving birth control and abortion, those issues don't necessarily loom as large among liberal Jewish groups as among certain more conservative Christian denominations, probably for that same reason. There hasn't been as large a pushback, which is not to say that, that there's unanimity in support. I think this was a very flawed piece of legislation. Very, very bad. I'm one of the few people who actually read the whole bill.
Wow.
And yet at the same time, there was certainly a need for reform. But personally, I'm not convinced that this was the way to go. But that's all. There's a conversation.
Yeah. Just a little factual question about. I mean, one of the things that the Catholic Church is worried about is how these mandates have affected various institutions, from universities to their hospitals. I know that there are a number of different Jewish hospitals around Cedars-Sinai in Los Angeles, right, is a very famous one. Do these hospitals tend to be run by different denominations across the board, or are they more Reform Jews running the hospitals versus Orthodox? Because I can imagine that would be an issue.
They tend not to be denominational, but community-supported. It's kind of supported by the Jewish community as a whole, okay, by Jewish philanthropy. Now, there could be some exceptions that I don't know about, but for the most part, when you hear such and such Jewish hospital, it doesn't mean that it's supported. It is run by Jewish Theological Seminary or Yeshiva University. It doesn't mean that at all.
Okay.
They're just larger Jewish supported by Jewish philanthropy, community organizations, and certainly the Jewish community organizations have buy-in, and the rabbis might sit on the board. But they are not strictly denominational, the same way that there are Adventist hospitals or Presbyterian hospitals or so on, or Lutheran hospitals.
Okay, I got it. That might explain why there might not be as big of an outcry or movement within the Jewish community then. But let's move on to the next topic here, one of the issues that you bring up in your book, Judaism and Health, and that's Jewish pastoral care and chaplaincy. And that, you know, gets to the issue of having people in hospitals as well as other places to really take care of the emotional and spiritual needs of individuals who find themselves in ill or in other dire straits. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in this field.
Sure, I just want to say that in kind of stepping through these different kind of interconnections of medicine and Judaism, so bioethics is one, health policy is one. There are a variety of other areas that have begun to coalesce small groups of professionals of one sort or another, and one group are people in the chaplaincy community and pastoral care community. And this, I could be wrong, kind of dates to about the late 1980s. There, of course, have always been Jewish people involved in chaplaincy and pastoral care, but the sense of a community coalescing together dates to about then. Rabbi Dale Friedman, who's a friend of mine, I think she did one of the book endorsements for this. She's a Reform rabbi that used to teach at the Reconstructionist Seminary. She's been instrumental in this field. I don't know how to sum this up. People have needs. People have, especially people that are in hospitals or in other settings, or Jews who are in the military, have needs. And can they be met by clergy in other religions? Maybe to some extent, yes, but in other ways, all of us have unique and characteristic needs, and there is a population of people that have come up to help address them, to provide spiritual care and to provide other sorts of care to people that are in need in institutional settings, either in the military, in hospitals, in the Veterans Administration, and this is this field has undergone a kind of professionalization in the last 20, 25 years. And there are now books available, and there are annual meetings and conferences, and I don't know what more to say. This is something that has evolved. But there have been other things. There's a Jewish hospice movement. Mm-hmm. Of course, there have been hospices for a long time. There have certainly been Jewish hospices. But over the last, 20 years or so, there's actually a movement. This is the Rabbi Lamb, Maurice Lamb. His brother was a longtime chancellor of Yeshiva University, an Orthodox university and seminary. And there's a movement. They have an annual meeting. They have a website. They have resources for people. They fill a need. There are hospice movements in Catholicism and in other Christian denominations. So now there is an organized, institutionalized movement among Jews as well. So there's pastoral care, chaplaincy, hospice. There are also, within the Jewish community, there is a unique, I want to call it an institution. It's kind of a meta-institution. And if any Jews are listening, they'll understand this. It's the Federation world. And large Jewish communities, or even medium-sized Jewish communities, have something called a federation, a local Jewish federation. And this is like kind of part Jewish community center, part social services agency, part cultural center, and in a lot of communities, this is a place for Jews to come together. It's part of the YMCA. There may be places to socialize. There's a film series. There's actually adoption agency. There's communal programming. And this is an organization that exists as an adjunct to and with some cooperation with the local congregations. And they are a font for fundraising and providing all sorts of programming and supportive resources. Right. I bring this up because a lot of the federations and community organizations throughout the country have begun to focus a lot of their programming on health and healing-related issues and aging-related issues, especially demographically. North American Judaism is a more rapidly aging community than some of our fellow religionists in the other denominations and other religions. And so aging-related issues are very important. There are training programs, support programs, referral programs, clinics. There was a report I saw, I wish I could put a date in, I think from like 2008 or 9, by one of the local federations in this country that was kind of surveyed a variety of the health and healing-related programming that went on in the federations across the country. And it was kind of like a best practices summary. And there was just everything I brought up and more, anything you can imagine. Home visiting programs, Meals on Wheels programs for elderly Jews, meditation and yoga classes in a Jewish context. Mm-hmm. Anything and everything that has something to do with health and healing has now become supported within the community. So that's like another point of intersection.
I want to ask a little bit about this communal programming, and trying to bring these things together, because and you mentioned that this has been a growing movement, trying to structure it a little bit more so than in the past, over the past 20 years or so. And one thing that has struck me in thinking about the American religious landscape is that as it's become easier to move out into suburbs over the past half century or so, Jewish communities, which oftentimes were very concentrated in specific neighborhoods and specific cities, now all of a sudden, you have somebody who's Jewish, they're moving out to the suburbs or to the exurbs. And given that it's a minority community to begin with, as you disperse out in the wilderness of suburbia, it's probably difficult to actually keep Jews together in that kind of community. So I would imagine that this is some kind of response to that new diaspora, if I could use that term.
I think the Federation world, and there are people that are more expert on this than me. I think it. The suburbanization, is that a word of Jewry, really was a phenomenon that occurred beginning after the war and in the 50s. And so we were no longer in our little ghetto, in our little communities and the ghettos and the urban areas. So we're like everybody else. We're spread out. We live in the suburbs. We live in the exurbs. And these federations became kind of de facto, like I say, part community center, part YMCA, part social service agency, part, place to to help needy people, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And for a lot of Jews, especially secular Jews, because we have a large number of people that aren't members of congregation, that are ethnically Jewish and Jewish by heritage and by self-identification, but are not religious Jews and don't go to services and don't belong to congregations, that the Jewish Community Center became the de facto house of gathering, mm-hmm. you know. And it's been especially important in an area in which people don't all live in the same community, and their shul or their synagogue is their everything, and they can walk a few blocks to it very easily and walk to the kosher butcher and mm-hmm. and et cetera. We're more spread out, and so these federations have served this function. Even in Waco, we are a small community. We have two synagogues, but we have a federation, and we, you know, four times a year we have meetings and we raise money, and we don't have a huge amount of programming, but we certainly meet, and our major function in our federation is to raise money locally and then send it to needy programs in Israel and send our kids to Jewish camps and things like that. So mm-hmm. we aren't into the whole social service thing, but these organizations have definitely served this function, and a significant proportion of what they do lately seems to be, to me, to be health and healing and aging related.
Yeah, I want to move to that next, because the brochure that you saw for that meeting at HUC, it leads us into this topic of healing. But before you brought up Waco and the Jewish community there, and if somebody had asked me, do you know anything about the Jewish community in Waco, and say, oh yeah, I know Jeff Levin. There you go. But you know, you have two synagogues, which is very interesting. My big question here is, do you guys all rally behind the Baylor Bears when they're playing football?
Well, you know, we have people in our congregation that, you know, went to law school at Baylor or whatever. I mean, actually, our shul, we're a conservative shul. It was an Orthodox shul for decades, and then around 1970 switched into the conservative movement. But we're very, very traditional. And then there's what's called a classical reform temple, which is much more the opposite end of the spectrum from us. But our congregation, in fact, I think in February is celebrating its 125th year.
Wow.
So for people listening, you know, how many churches out there are that old?
Yeah.
In fact, Jews, I was told, helped settle Central Texas.
Wow.
German Jews helped settle Central Texas. And in fact, I think a lot of the land that is downtown Waco, including some of the land that Baylor sits on, was originally Jewish land that was donated to the city or to the university. In fact, there's an old Jewish cemetery that nobody's been buried in for almost 100 years that's literally within the limits of the Baylor campus across the river from the new football stadium.
Wow.
So there's been Jewish people here for a long, long, long time.
More evidence of ecumenism, I guess. So there you go. So tell us about this Jewish healing movement, and it gets into...
Sure. I mean, it sounds kind of, you know, New Agey, Jewish healing movement.
Yeah. But
actually not. This is essentially a loose collection of, just like there's federations in various communities, there are in many communities now, oftentimes affiliated with the local federation, but oftentimes not, something called a Jewish Healing Center. Now, this, you know, what in the world goes on? Are there people laying hands on people? No. These are basically private or communal organizations that are set up to deliver a lot of the health and healing related programming, and a lot of these Jewish healing centers are sponsored by the local federation. So this is just these are so for example, there's a National Center for Jewish Healing, NCJH. Listeners might want to look up. This is kind of a national clearinghouse, and they publish materials that are resource materials for people that'll help them if they're ever in hospitals, and resource materials for doctors or rabbis or other folks. They're also the local Jewish centers might sponsor classes, meditation classes. They do a lot of the work, a lot of the healing and health related training and community outreach that would go on in that community under the auspices of the local federation. One of the kind of de facto leaders of this movement is a dear man, friend of mine, Rabbi Simcha Weintraub in New York, and this is, you know, while Jewish healing movement sounds kind of New Agey, he is a conservative rabbi and on the faculty of Jewish Theological Seminary, and a wonderful, wonderful man, and a social worker. And I don't know how many of these healing centers there are throughout the country, dozens of them. One can go to the NCJH, National Center of Jewish Healing website, and find all of them and see the various work that they do. Mainly they exist to provide resources and sponsor classes and do trainings and that sort of thing.
Yeah, we'll go ahead and link to that spot, or the link to the National Center for Jewish Healing on our website, so people can make a easy trip over to our website and then track it down there. Really interesting kind of stuff. Is it connected with this Kabbalah movement or anything?
Well, not necessarily.
Okay.
And, you know, Kabbalah is Jewish mysticism, and I always like to say there's Kabbalah and there's Kabbalah. You know, and there was a time in the 1980s when I was younger where I had an interest in Jewish mysticism, and I wanted to try to read everything in English translation on Kabbalah, and I was coming close. And then as kind of the whole New Age movement exploded, what was out there exploded as well. And, you know, all I can say is I don't want to be disparaging, but for every wonderful volume of historical writing on Jewish mysticism by a learned rabbi, there are now 10 or 20 books on, Kabbalah and tarot cards for the modern witch and 10 easy lessons.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've all heard of, you know, Madonna and her amulets, and that has nothing to do with anything that as a Jew I would call Kabbalah. But why it's important here is that one of the things that's going on in these Jewish healing centers and communally and even in congregations, you now more and more are seeing classes on Jewish meditation, Jewish psychology and healing, and even Jewish, you know, classes on Kabbalah and healing. And so it's just another part of this whole development and interest. And, you know, healing is a pretty big, it's a big tent.
Yeah.
And you know, on the one hand, we have, learned rabbis issuing, biomedical response and ethical decision-making. And on the other hand, you have people in classes on yoga mats learning to meditate and study the Kabbalah and, you know, mm-hmm. and everything in between.
Yeah.
But the point is, these are all points of connection between the Jewish religion and health and healing, and it's a phenomenon really the last 20 or 30 years. But I've got to tell you, there's one more, because I know time's winding down, there's one more point of connection that's near and dear to my heart that I focused on, and that has been actual, you know, empirical research.
And that's so what I wanted to turn to next, yeah.
Mm-hmm. These are all, everything that we've talked about, these are all more kind of institutional overlaps between religion and medicine and Judaism. But as somebody that's for 30 years been doing epidemiologic and sociological research on religion and health, the natural question arises, was how much of this work has dealt with Jews? And the answer is, until recently, very little. And I, over the years, now and again, find little one-off studies of religion and health done in, kibbutzes in Israel or in England or something like that. But in the last, I'm going to say, 3 or 4 years, two large programs of empirical research have evolved, and one of them's my own. One is by a young man, Dr. David Rosemarin, who's a psychologist. He was trained by Dr. Ken Pargament, who's a name a lot of listeners might know, a wonderful psychologist at Bowling Green, an Orthodox Jew, and a friend of mine probably for 25 years. And Ken trained David. David is now, I think, at Harvard or McLean Hospital. He's a psychologist. And he has a website called, aptly, J-Psych, J-P-S-Y-C-H, and it has links to probably over 20 studies that he has done in the last few years looking at the mental health and psychological outcomes, mostly of Orthodox Jews in the United States. Now, these are psychological studies. These are small clinical samples or community samples or internet studies, not the type of research I do as an epidemiologist, but he's able, these are original studies, to go very in-depth. People have been assessed for depressive symptoms, anxiety, psychological distress, and he's asked fabulous questions, not just, do you go to the temple or not, or are you Jewish or not, but he's developed indices to assess things like bitachon, trust in God, emunah, faith, really to dig down deep and in depth on Jewish religious observance and beliefs and attitudes. And kind of in a nutshell, what he's found throughout all these 20-plus studies is that Jewish religious observance, seems to be, as we would say in epidemiology, a protective factor against psychological distress. Or phrased another way, lack of, as a Christian would say, a faith commitment, if I use that word in Judaism, a faith commitment or formal religious expression seems to elevate the risk for depressive symptoms and anxiety disorders, and also to just make things a little more difficult related to health as well, physical health, although the evidence is not real clear cut. So this is fabulous work. There's a wonderful, wonderful young man. Think the world of him. He has. There's a chapter summarizing this work in the latest book you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The second program of research on religion and health in Jews has been my own work, and the challenge here, unless there's one that I haven't heard of, nobody has ever done a global epidemiologic survey of the world's Jews and assess their health and their religion, and I can't imagine that happening anytime soon. So as someone also trained in the social sciences, I've been on the lookout for existing data sets, existing surveys that were done of large populations in which there were enough Jews in the sample to do analyses, and that also had health data and religion data. And as you can imagine, that it's very unlikely.
Right.
But I found in the last 3 years, I've published 8 studies using a variety of data sets that I found that fit this. And these are mostly studies that were done in Israel. So these are global surveys of the world's population in which they all had Israeli samples. And as a result, these were samples of mostly Jews, and questions were asked on religion, questions were asked on health, and is this ideal? One of the drawbacks of secondary analysis is that you didn't write the variables yourself, you didn't write the questions yourself, so you're stuck with what's in there. The flip side is, in my case, these are large national probability surveys. These are outstanding population surveys of thousands of people. So here they are. I'll list them out, and people can look up the studies. The Gallup World Poll had an Israeli sample. The World Value Survey, the European Social Survey, the International Social Survey Program, the Israeli Social Survey, several more. And I delved into these. I delved into these data sets. They all asked one or two questions on religion. And these surveys as a whole, variably, some of them had questions on mental health, some had a couple questions on physical health, some of them asked neither, but maybe there was a question on well-being, like on happiness or life satisfaction. And so over all of these surveys, each one of them, I did a data analysis, published a paper. So here's the take-home point. What did I find? Was there anything consistent? Yes, interestingly, there was. We were able to find that, on the whole, Jewish religiousness, however conceived in these studies, seemed to be positively associated with better well-being. And that meant either people that were more committed to Judaism were more likely to say that they were happy, that they were satisfied with their life, they had fewer depressive symptoms, they, to some extent, even rated their health better, although the results were a little ambiguous. They had less psychological distress, and so on. And this was fascinating. And this held across all of these various global surveys. So is this conclusive? Not entirely, because I didn't design any of these surveys. But there's also a lesson to any of us who do research that where existing data are available, they can be mined. And mm-hmm. and I don't think that the people who designed these global surveys had any intention, any idea that somebody was going to go in and do a series of studies on religion and health in Israelis, but the data are there. And these large global data programs are wonderful resources for social and health scientists who have obscure interests. For me, it'd be fantastic if the National Institutes of Health would give me $10 million to do a global health survey. But I don't think that's gonna happen.
Yeah.
A survey of religion and health in Jews. I don't think that's gonna happen. And frankly, I have a more libertarian bent. I don't necessarily think it should happen.
Yeah.
But these existing data sources allowed me to do a variety of these analyses. And if people go to the website Institute for Studies of Religion at Baylor and look under publications, you'll find links to, again, we're up to 8 studies, and there's a couple more in the works. And then I'm out of data sets at that point.
Okay. Well, we definitely will link to that. And it also sounds as if your research is really confirming a lot of the stuff that has happened in research on Christianity and health as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what's really exciting, because we've got 30 years of research showing the faith factor is really valuable for mental health and even for physical health. And the question is, does this translate to Jews? And what I've been able to do in my studies, and David Rosemarin and his, has showed that it's pretty much, you know, our variables are a little different. We don't go to church. We don't pray to Jesus and things like that. But, but when we ask questions specific to Jewish religious observance, we're pretty much getting the same results.
So you said that you're coming close to tapping out these existing data sources, and the NIH is not waving a big, huge bag of money in your face to do more.
Study of Jewish religion.
Right. So I guess that leaves off with my last question is, what's next for Jeff Levin? Where does this stuff go? Are more scholars being trained in this? Is there a growing interest in it? And what's up for you next?
Well, the larger religion and health field, you know, when I started, it was very marginal. You know, like 5 of us sitting around a table being really beleaguered. But this is 30 years ago, and according to my friend Dr. Harold Koenig at Duke, there are now north of about 4,000 studies that have been done. So there's a religion and health. It's now, I don't know if it's mainstream, but it's, you know, people are doing this work, and findings are being published in journals, and professional meetings have papers on this, and people get grants and so on. The Judaism angle, I don't know. There aren't a whole lot of people, certainly, that do the empirical research like I do, that also have an interest in this, but maybe that'll change. My papers have been coming out over the last 2 or 3 years. David Rosemarin's have been coming out in the same period of time. Ken Pargaman and Bowling Green's been doing a little work. So I think probably, like anything else, once this work is out there and it's publicized, that it might spark a little more interest. But at the same time, unless somebody has an interest, I mean, religion and health is not, you know, you get trained as an epidemiologist. This isn't one of the usual things you study. You're studying, you know, cholera or malaria or something, and or maybe you do psychosocial research. You study stress or type A behavior. You're not studying religion. So the population of people that might do this work is much smaller to have an interest in religion. At the same time, I think unless you were Jewish, I don't know why you would really focus in here. I mean, by the same token, there's actually there have been some research on religion and health within Islam, but that's even smaller than this field. I only know of one guy that's done this programmatically. I think his name's Dr. Kalik. I think he's an Egyptian. And so that field is even smaller than the Jewish field. So I don't know. The other thing, like I say, I'm out of data sets now. So unless someone's going to give me a big grant, I've done all the secondary analysis that I can.
Mm-hmm.
What's next? Certainly I'm open to doing, you know, if you've got any rich billionaire Jewish philanthropists listening to your podcast, I'd be happy to talk to them.
Yep.
George Soros is listening. But if that's not the case, I have so many irons in the fire. One of the things that I'm doing right now is writing essays about the role for faith-based institutions and public health policy. So mm-hmm. That whole angle interests me. I've been to the events at the Heritage Foundation. I've written some papers on the Surgeon General of the United States and where kind of interaction with the faith-based sector could come in. So just in general, how the faith-based sector and the public health sector can interact in order to further national population health goals. So this is not an empirical research field, but this is something else that I've been very involved in. And the Judaism and health stuff's been something I've been doing just kind of to keep up my research chops. But like I say, it's winding down.
Yeah. Well, you do have a lot of irons in the fire, and it's good to see that you're keeping busy in addition to watching Baylor football and basketball. But we'll be keeping track on what you're doing with the faith-based initiatives and other things in the future, and we'll be glad to have you back on the show in a little while.
Fantastic.
So, Jeff, thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org.
If you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.